That was my greatest contribution to New Testament studies, was making sure Bob got control of all the manuscripts. Everything else has been downhill since. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. My law practice includes a lot of criminal defense, so this is a lot nicer looking crowd than I'm accustomed to hanging out with, except for a few people, I think. You know, being a lawyer is much simpler than being a seminary professor. If a Christian leader does something wrong, hey, can we just do something about this ring?
Yeah.
What should we do?
We're working on it.
Ah, okay. Okay, that sounds better. Yeah, it's a lot easier being a lawyer, because if a Christian leader does something wrong, it's a scandal. But if a lawyer does something good, it's a miracle. So there's the expectations are so low that it's just a great feeling of freedom. Law school was easier than biblical studies, too. The first day of law school at orientation, they gave you the speech about how tough it was going to be. Probably given it in every law school in the country for years. The person on your left, your right, one of y'all is not going to be here in a few days. Then I got to thinking, I was rushing from my business at the time for this orientation section, and I started thinking, I thought, well, you know, how can it be that hard? It's all in English. And the more recent the documents, the more reliable it was. And so, you know, that's so different from biblical. You know, when I went did my doctoral work, I had to know four languages, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and German. That was a lot harder than law school, I'll tell you. We actually took a class in legal ethics. People are surprised to hear that. Yeah, it's true. You actually take a course in ethics in law school. But it was so difficult that we never got past the first question and issue that was raised on the first day, which was, if a client pays you twice on the same invoice, should you tell your partner? It was way beyond the ability of the average lawyer to address that, so we spent all semester debating it. You know, a lot of clients come in, they wonder about, you know, about billing. The first thing they ask is, well, what do you charge per hour? And I always tell them that, you know, I don't really think of it that way. I like to try to answer questions or issues. So about $300 for three issues. And the person looked at me and said, well, isn't that a lot? And I said, well, not really. I said, what's your third question? You know, I deal with a lot of prosecutors and defense attorneys sometimes look at life differently. Prosecutors, particularly the new ones, are sort of young, right out of law school, very fervent, idealistic. And, you know, the defense attorneys sometimes can be a little bit jaded. I heard two of them talking the other day in the courthouse, and the prosecutor was telling the defense attorney, who was a friend, how he had told his son the story of Peter and the wolf to teach him not to lie. And he said, yeah, how old is your son? He says, 10 years old. Well, what did you teach him? I said, well, I explained to him how he kept lying about being a wolf. And finally, when there was a wolf, you know, nobody believed him. He was killed by the wolf. And the defense attorney says, well, that seems kind of harsh, you know, for a 10-year-old kid. He said, in fact, I don't even think that's the lesson you draw from that story. And the prosecutor said, really? Well, what do you think the lesson is? And the clever defense attorney said, well, the lesson is you never tell the same lie twice. And nah, that's actually prosecutors and attorneys, some of the nicest people I've ever been around. I did hear that story, but I think they were joking. The law is just my tent making, just like, you know, for Paul it was tent making. My main purpose in life, is, hopefully, is just like yours, is being an ambassador for Christ. And so I'm really thankful I get to be here and share a few things, how I would tweak a curriculum in systematic theology. And I'm not going to go into all the reasons why I would make some of these conclusory statements, because I want you, if something raises your interest, jot it down and say, well, why did you say that, or why do you think that? Because I don't want to give all the reasons for it. I just want to touch on some of the areas that I would change. And so this is not really an outline of all of systematic theology. Only the Roman numerals and some of the things are the main categories, but within which I just address things that I might tweak, adjust, emphasize because of, you know, modern times. And so that's, it might raise your interest, and I'll be glad to talk to you about it either now or later. You know, feel free to email me. I won't give you my email address, but you know, you can email me any questions you have. Okay, if I were teaching systematic theology today, and I could design the curriculum, I would start off, probably have at least one course in general revelation and philosophy, because I found that it hindered people's theology if they didn't have at least some of the fundamentals set in their mind. It was really deeply ingrained, the way they looked at life, if it wasn't really grounded in solid philosophy. Now, there's three primary areas of philosophy: ontology, epistemology, and causality. Ontology is the study of being. There's only two kinds of being. You can either exist dependently or independently. The reason for the existence can either be within the entity like God, or it depends upon something else. Everything we see here is dependently existent. There's not anything that you look at that didn't come from something else. Now, you can't have an infinite regression of finite causes, and that becomes one of the primary arguments for the existence of God. It's very important at the beginning of theology to understand that. The most important fact about ontology is there has to be a self-existent being, because you cannot have an infinite regression of finite causes. The reason you can't have an infinite regression, because if that went back infinitely, you would never get to the present. And that's one of the primary arguments for the existence of God. Similarly, you can take some of the non-material things that we experience, goodness, truth, and beauty, and you can show that unless there's a finite reference point for those things, they have no meaning. It's just illusory. And so that becomes one of the second ontological foundations for the existence of God. And so I would emphasize that in that course. I'd probably have two or three lectures on that. Epistemology, I would cover at least some of the major issues in epistemology. Epistemology is how you know things. And in the history of philosophy, you have two major brands of thought on this. You have rationalism or empiricism. Empiricism says you know everything through your physical senses. Rationalism says, no, it's much more important to have pre-existent rational categories. And then Kant combined these two to say, well, you really have to have both. But then he split all that. And then you get people like Duyavert, who said, well, you have to start with naive experience, which links concepts and percepts, and that's how we know. But it's just important to know the difference between this, because it comes up all the time. I was in law school, for example. I was in an evidence class, and I remember I couldn't believe it that the professor, who's very well-educated, written a number of articles in evidence, said that he didn't believe anything unless it could be verified through the senses. Well, it's such a silly statement of, you know, an old debunked philosophy that, you know, everything we know has to be empirical. And so I raised my hand, as I often did, and I just asked him, I said, well, which of your physical senses detects your own thoughts? And you don't taste them, you don't smell them, you don't, well, you know, metaphorically, but you don't see them, you don't hear them. You detect your own thoughts through the spirit. And there are a number of things like that. You don't detect morality through the senses. You don't detect beauty or goodness. Those things are all known. They're all immaterial. And so empiricism is really kind of a silly view. But rationality, that is everything is known, you know, prior to experience, is also not completely correct. So Plato is not quite right about that either. But in any case, it's just, if I were teaching a course, you asked me what one thing I would cover in philosophy after ontology, I would cover some of the basics of epistemology so they understood where this was coming from in modern thought, because it comes up all the time, and usually it's hidden or disguised. And then I would talk about causality, and this is really the issue of free will and determinism. Determinism is ultimately self-defeating, because that means that everything you think was already determined. It wasn't really based on anything rational. And so another aspect of causality deals with how the mind relates to the body. Now, those two issues, I would cover that in systematic theology, I mean, as in the prolegomena section, so that people would understand this. And then I would talk about the creator-creation distinction and the significance of that. You see, unless you have a creator-creation distinction, so that we exist in a dimension that's inferior to God's, you really have no logical explanation for what we eventually come to in systematic theology. There's at least four great theological mysteries, not in the Pauline sense, but I mean the sense where it appears to be contradictory. And unless you have some kind of logical answer for that, then the critics, and it's usually liberal critics, England was big on this 20 years ago, they said Christianity is really ultimately fails, because you can't have something that's contradictory. You can't have something that's finite and infinite in the same person. It's a reasonable objection to make. And the response to that was really not very good. And so, but if you have a creation-creation distinction, you have a God above this, and then you get into the, and I'll, some of you might recall this from class, but you get into arguments from dimensionality, is that things that could be true in one dimension, in two dimensions, are not true in one. Things which can be true in three dimensions can't be true in, I mean, things can be true in three that aren't true in two, and vice versa. And, for example, you've heard about the doctrine of immanence and transcendence. Well, that sounds like there's, where's the contradictory there? Well, I'll tell you where the contradiction is there in immanence and transcendence. It means God is everywhere, but he's nowhere. Well, wait a second. What do you mean? Well, we say God's immanent. He's everywhere. You know, he's very near. What, can you touch him anywhere? No. So he's really nowhere. How can that be true? It can only be true if God exists in a dimension outside of us. In the same way, a two-dimensional plane going through a three-dimensional sphere theoretically doesn't touch anything within that sphere, this whole planet can be within the dimension of God, and God can be everywhere but nowhere. It'd be as if, let's imagine you lived in a two-dimensional mirror, and, you know, looked like an Egyptian hieroglyph going back and forth, and then someone put their hand in the mirror, then you couldn't imagine that hand had depth, but it still could have depth. There could put another hand behind it, and there could still be two. It opens up explanations like this that are not just metaphorical, but actually physically true. And that becomes, I think, should be the proper basis for understanding all of these mysteries. Same thing with the deity and humanity of Christ. This will shock you. I'm not so keen on the concept of two natures. I think there's probably a better way to express that Christ was finite and infinite at the same time. I would rather say that he lived in two dimensions, because when you speak of two natures, it makes it appear like within him there's two different things. And it's always kind of puzzled me. So I think I would tweak that in the creeds and try to come up with another way to formulate that. Trinitarianism of the Trinity, well, that's the dimensionality allows for that, doesn't necessitate that, although you could argue for threeness from the nature of personality, like Augustine said, where there's love, there's Trinity, a lover, a beloved, and a spirit of love. So, yeah, you can sort of imply that, but I think we know that by special revelation. And then another area of where we have a conflict without dimensionality is sovereignty and choice. That, you know, there's a lot of passages that teach that God really, you know, does everything. There's a lot of passages that teach that your choices are genuine. Both are true. How can both be true if you don't have that dimensionality factor? That's where I say with general revelation, I would start this so we don't run into all these problems later on when we concluded our theology 3 or 4 years later and ended up with these great spiritual truths that are in all the creeds. So that's where I would try to integrate some of the beginning of systematics. I'll make sure that we understood some basic things in philosophy and general revelation. Special revelation, prolegomena, although that would be taught in a different area, I would try to teach that in my class, and I would go into hermeneutics theory. I would say it's not, my starting point would not be primarily literal or primarily grammatico-historical. Those are okay, but they're really kind of statements of, or peculiar. To say it's literal, most people really mean by that when they say it, that they just believe that it's true. They're not really making a statement about how you interpret. They're saying, well, whatever it says, it's true. Okay, I got you. That's not really a principle of interpretation. Same thing with grammatico-historical. You know, people can tweak it and mean different things by it, but, well, of course you're going to have to understand grammar and a little bit of history to understand that, but it's still not a great principle of interpretation. And so I would simply go back to the philosophy where in epistemology we dealt with logic, and I would try to explain all the principles of induction, because there's only two kinds of application of logic. That's induction and deduction. And they kind of converge at certain points. But with induction, you're really just implying, you take all the data and try to get the simplest theory that explains the most data. And then there are all kind of little rules that apply. Books have been written on it. Popper wrote a book, you know, Scientific Method, and all kind of people write about it, and they apply it to their fields. I'm telling you, it's not any different when you interpret literature. It is just the logical principles of induction as applied to literature. And, you know, when I was in seminary, and then shortly after, everybody was using Hirsch's book on principles of interpretation. I thought it was ridiculous. I thought it was ridiculous when I was a student, because all Hirsch was doing was, in a very clumsy way, applying principles of induction to literature. And he didn't need to go into all that kind of stuff that he did. It'd be much simpler, more to the point, just to stick to the basic axioms of induction. And then the most important principle of interpretation begins, you interpret according to literary genre. That would be my starting point. Roman numeral 1, interpret according to literary genre. because that's really what we're talking about here. I mean, what kind of genre do we have? And because this really does become an issue in interpretation. You know, what genre do we have? Is it allegorical? No. Well, is it just history? No, there's too much theology in the narrative. And one of the biggest areas where we miss the literary genre, in my opinion, where I did a lot of work on, was in biblical narrative. And even though you won't find this in much of the literature, I really don't think that the literature genre changes from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Because the same thing I see in Genesis, where Abraham goes down to Egypt, comes out of Egypt laden with gifts, that's the same thing I see in the book of Matthew, where Jesus reduplicates the history of Israel. All the book of Matthew is designed to reduplicate the history of Israel. It's the exact same thing. There is a historical element, and there's a story going along with the history. It's not allegory. That doesn't have history. It's history and story at the same time. And so unless we can really articulate what that kind of genre is, we're going to miss out a great many things about what the Scriptures are really trying to teach us. So I would really try to emphasize that. Hermeneutics application, I think it would be very helpful and also very edifying to trace the four strands of biblical thought up through the New Testament. It's easier to see in the New Testament than the Old. But the New Testament, before we get to our biblical theology precedes systematic, so you want to gather up all your points. And so really what you have in the New Testament is Matthew and James is one strand of thought, and then you have Mark and Mark's really the Gospel of Peter. You have Mark and Peter's literature, which has a lot of correlations. Then you have the biggest corpus, you have Luke, Acts, Paul, and then you have the Johannine literature, and of course, including Revelation. Those are the four main strands within the New Testament, and they all express the same truths in slightly different ways. It'd be as if you had a sculpture, and you can actually get copyright on photographs of sculpture. You can't get it on a painting because you don't have anything new. But on sculpture, you can look at it from, you know, four or five different angles, and you bring out something different every time. And that's exactly what the Gospels do. So some of you may have suffered through some course on the life of Christ, and they cut up all the Gospels and make them all fit together into one. It's like making a Frankenstein. That totally obliterates what the purpose of the four Gospels are. It drives me crazy. But anyway, that's a different issue. Anyway, you inductively arrive at creedal truths, then deductively present it in systematic theology. Let's see. Ah, yes. So now we get into theology proper in biblical. Not that the other was improper theology, but it refers to that when you deal at the very beginning on issues of the attributes of God and so forth. And again, this is not a total outline. These are just things I would emphasize or change. I would really emphasize now, and actually we have to do a lot more work in it, but to emphasize the unity of the special revelation with general revelation. Because I agree with Paul that we know about God's existence prior to special revelation, unlike some of the radical presuppositionalists. I don't know what they're talking about. Paul clearly taught that we knew about the existence of God in Romans 1. He echoed what Paul Tillich would later make a career out of, in him we move and act and have our being, in Acts 17. And so we already know about the existence of God, about morality, about a lot of things before special revelation comes to us. But in order to lock in the authenticity of the original revelation, you've got to get a really tight connection with general revelation. And that's something that apologists really haven't done. They haven't really shown the correlation between what we know, say, in the Torah, and what we know, you know, from about God in ontology, epistemology, all those other things that we've learned about from general revelation. So I would emphasize that, and then I would make that probably the primary apologetic of the entire Bible. You lock it in with general revelation, and then you show the unity of the Scripture throughout. Because, you know, just a few years ago it was popular to elevate the Gnostic Gospels as something important. You know, maybe they were early, maybe they weren't. It didn't make any difference. They didn't fit in with the Old Testament, you know. So it didn't matter if they'd been written at 50 A.D. They were not harmonious with what we already knew about God from the Old Testament. In Christology, especially after all this sort of academic thought that we do at seminary, I would definitely want to emphasize as much as I could the importance of the personal relationship, because, you know, no matter how academic we get in this, and I don't mind being academic, I don't think it takes away anything, but we can never get away from the fundamental reality that it is an intensely personal relationship individually with Christ, so that Peter can say, whom having not seen, you love. Can you imagine that? He's writing to people who have never seen Christ, but they have this heartfelt love for Christ. And Peter, I'm always blown away by that little phrase. You never get away from the intensity of that personal relationship. And I would also emphasize, because I think it comes back and sheds light on everything else, the importance of the incarnation. I was sitting talking to three young prosecutors in Denton County about a year and a half ago. No, it's about 2 years ago. It was right before Easter. And we were sitting there negotiating cases. And they were all Christians. As you find a lot of, believe it or not, a lot of lawyers are Christians, I guess, you know, confessing all their many, many sins from being lawyers. But in any case, we were sitting there talking about Easter coming up. I said, you know, you may not believe this, but you have to admit that to think that the claim is the most amazing claim anybody's ever made, that the person who made this entire universe, I mean, it's vast, it's incomprehensible, it's, you know, it's amazing. And to say that this God who made everything would become a person, it's an incredible claim. It's an incredible claim. And, you know, and that then sheds light on so many other areas of theology, because is there any kind of problem with preservation of the Scripture? You know, so you have to worry about canonicity. Did they make this mistake or that? No. If God could become a man, you don't think he could preserve the Scripture that he gave us? So I think it would end up shedding a light on everything else that we studied in theology. So it's still mind-boggling to me, and I'm thankful for it. It makes me want to fall down and worship every time I think about it. It's just amazing. Pneumatology. This is not an outline of pneumatology. It's just some of the things that I've seen arise where that subject would be addressed. Still problems on gifts. You know, a good friend of mine from Dallas Seminary, Jack Deere, you know, became a very spokesman for the gifts and all that. He wrote a book, Surprised by the Spirit. He and I were trout fishing up in, we were fly fishing up in Montana shortly after that. I said, you know, I wrote a sequel to your book. He said, really, what was that? I said, it's called Surprised by the Exegesis. And he I didn't really write it, but, you know, we were joking around about it. But, you know, he really believed all that stuff. But I think, to me, of course, I never did, because I thought that the most fundamental thing with the gifts is, first, determine what they are. And I used to tell my students that, too, even more. Because now, you know, Wayne Grudem popularized the view, well, prophecy is not really prophecy. You know, I'll be right about half the time, a third of the time. New Testament prophecy is not the same as Old Testament prophecy. I don't find any support for that. In fact, I was getting ready to go talk to Jack about this about 10 years ago. I thought, well, I better come up with a new argument that I hadn't heard so I can kind of throw him off. And so I started reading through the passages, and I thought, oh, I've got one. You know, women can prophesy in 1 Corinthians 11, but they're not allowed to speak, 1 Corinthians 14. How can that be? Think about it. I think there might be. I throw this out to fellow students because this is the kind of thing we debate amongst ourselves. I wonder if it means that she's not speaking. And therefore, it's absolutely true from God. It can't be some of this right one half of the time. It's one way to resolve that apparent contradiction between 1 Corinthians 11 and 14. And, of course, then there are the people that espouse it. You know, I don't know about you. When I watch them, I think, you know, I'm not seeing the Spirit of Christ here. You know, it doesn't resonate with me. And my son, I have three sons. One of my sons told me the same thing. He goes, God, the guy's doing this and doing that and all this crazy stuff. He said, I can't imagine you being that way or Christ being that way. And you think about that. If you don't really know the person of Christ from the Gospels, you don't see that same wild spirit that these guys. They're all a bunch of charlatans, it looks like to me. Anyway, I don't have to, you know, answer to anybody, so I can say whatever I want to up here. Anyway, so, okay, next thing. So we just go God, man, and salvation, because salvation is going to cover soteriology, ecclesiology, and eschatology. So under man, anthropology, hamartiology, angelology, and demonology, that's really man and other created beings. Again, I would begin with some apologetic things on the immaterial nature of man, because there's kind of a radical empiricism. The mind can be reduced to the brain, which is impossible, but there's still that kind of a popular view. I think if I would tweak what I would consider the nature of man just a little bit, because I think most evangelicals, like myself, growing up in this world, I think we have what I would now call, I made up a word, I think I did, ratiocentric. It was kind of too much of a rational nature of man. That's just one aspect of man. And so I think that we probably have neglected the other aspects, and I don't think that's really the core of who we are, is our mind. I think the core is the heart, which is deeper. But I would want to develop that and go through passages on that. And I would also still emphasize a lot against evolution. I think that's the first big fake news that went out there, and it just got repeated so often that everybody believed it. And I would, just as a layperson, myself, as a layperson, I'm not a scientist, I would still divide any kind of arguments I had into a twofold presentation. I would say that the laws of physics would never predict it, and the empirical evidence doesn't support it. And that would be Roman numeral 1 and 2. And so under the laws of physics, I go through the first and second law of thermodynamics, and I would explain that you don't get order out of chaos, you get more chaos. Given an infinite amount of time, it's just more likely you're going to have chaos. And so I would hit the rules, and then I would go through, you know, when the theory first came out, they figured they'd fill in the gaps. They never filled in the gaps. So anyway, that's the way I would divide that. And that could be, you know, two volumes, but that's the way I would still divide the big paradigm in. You know, laws wouldn't predict it. Evidence doesn't support it. Angels and demons, what I have in my notes is still a big blind spot, unless you're watching politics. And then you have an easier time seeing these horribly evil things going on. I don't even want to get into that, but I would hope we all have similar views on that. If not, hear me rant some night about it all. Okay. And then the last thing is salvation, and there I would put the three subjects. You know, the beginning of it, of salvation, is what we normally had in soteriology, and then ecclesiology would be important, and then eschatology. It's all part of the same, you know, beginning to the end of salvation. Or another big picture item you can do on that, you can start in Genesis and say God lost people in the earth, and the rest of the Bible is through prophet, priests, and kings, he's going to regain a people in the earth. That's another overview you can have on that. So Bob, even like this, why works are useless, why works are essential. Anytime we talk about that, and I think we all probably have similar views on why works are useless, but why works are essential, that seems to be the real bone of contention in our groups, is that, well, it's not necessary for assurance of salvation. And so, but this is, I would still hold that in balance. We're his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God has preordained that we should walk in them. So, you know, we still want to hold these in balance. I was talking to a guy the other day who was embarrassed to talk about works. You know, like, well, you know, I don't want to look like I'm under the law because he's doing works. I said, well, what are you talking about? I said, you know, if you don't do something, you know, this, you're going to fail in this, that, and the other. There's a lot of things you've got to do. This is where James, you know, really comes in and helps. And, you know, actually, a lot of the passages taken as assurance of salvation through works passage is really about being, you know, profitable and enriched by your works. There's nothing wrong with work. I mean, my goodness, I don't understand that. You know, there's nothing more attractive about a child than a child that wants to please his parents. And he pleases his parents by doing things that please them. I mean, this is all we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about works that please God. It's not, if you're doing it because you think your dad's going to beat you, that might be one thing. But if it's just trying to please your parents, it's okay. Ecclesiology. Not a means to material gain. Wow. Well, we could talk a long time about that. I've had to walk out of a few sermons. You know, men of depraved mind thinks it's a means to material gain, 1 Timothy 6. I heard a well-known preacher that would not be like, you know, one of the prosperity guys, not a Joel Osteen type guy. And he was speaking on Genesis 22. And I wonder why I left there. Was that really Genesis 22 he was speaking on? Here was the message. You know, nothing about the beloved son and sacrifice. Nothing about the precursor. It raises this big question. How could a man sacrifice his son? It raises this huge question. You know, liberal theologians, oh, this is ridiculous. How can a man sacrifice? Well, it raises this question. It's finally answered when we see God's going to sacrifice his own son. Nothing about that. Nothing about the technical term beloved son that arises there, used a few times in the Old Testament, and then applied to Jesus at the baptism. Nothing about the standard great truths from Genesis 22. Rather, he didn't have to sacrifice him. He no doubt rejoiced, we're not reading about that, when they went back home, and they celebrated. So you can celebrate too when good things happen and go on our cruise with us this summer. What? Yes. I heard it with my own ears. I thought, did I really just hear that? But I did. I witnessed it myself. I heard that myself. The 2 Kings 5, this is a true story too. Not more than a few months later, we were in 2 Kings, and I think this is the last time I went, actually, to this church, but 2 Kings 5, great pastor. This is where Naaman the Syrian, you know, is cured of his leprosy. He's first he rejects, this is too simple, You know, and so he's not going to bathe in the Jordan seven times and so forth. But if finally somebody talks him into it, he's healed. He goes back and wants to give Elisha all these gifts and all this money and everything. He said, this is free. Great illustrations on free grace, great illustrations on the simplicity of the gospel. But then there's always somebody who wants to make money out of it. So his servant goes out and he says, hey, big mistake, feel free to give it to me, you know. And so anyway, so then he's the one that gets leprosy. But so this is our passage. Guess what? Not a single word on the person who tried to make money out. I mean, which was one of the main points of that story, you know. Actually, there wasn't even a single word on the simplicity of the gospel either that I recall. I don't know what it was about now I can't remember. But there it is. This is in like a mainstream church, you know. And what happens when you're so immersed in materialism and you think this really is a means of material gain, it starts skewing the way you look at everything. It's kind of like these churches that are, you know, trying to get women to start preaching in the church now. You know, all of a sudden all these passages mean something different than what they apparently mean. You know, you just start seeing things a little bit differently. By the way, on why works, this is circling back to echo the words of our new press secretary. Circling back, this is on why works are useless. What does scurvy, COVID, and the gospel have in common? I don't know either. No, I do know. I know what my answer is. The solutions are rejected because they're so simple. You know, scurvy is just a vitamin C. The gospel is often rejected. That must be too simple. You say, well, what about COVID? That's a different discussion. My brother, you know, is a famous doctor. He was the smart one in the family. He wrote medical books that were used in 30 countries, translated a bunch of languages. And he told me like 2 years ago, he said, well, if this ever makes it here, he said, just get a small amount of hydrocortisone. I said, how come? And he explained, I don't understand it, but I can tell you what he said. He said, influenza virus and coronavirus have one thing in common. They destroy the pituitary's ability to send a signal to your adrenal gland. And without that, the adrenal gland doesn't produce a small amount of cortisol, which triggers the immune system. So if you just have that, you know, it'll be fine. He said, nobody has to die from this thing. Well, you know, I had it. 140 people, other people that he treated had it. They all got over between 18 and 24 hours. So it's worth investigating, you know. But again, why the kind of, you cannot believe the pushback we got when we said, you ought to really, you know, check this out. I talked to some endocrinologists about it. They were the ones that are most convinced of it. But, you know, people resist stuff that's because it's too simple. So we got tired of, you know, we shared it with some friends. A lot of people got better, and everybody did that took it. But in any case, it's people are going to reject something if it looks too simple, and that's true of the gospel. Okay, so not a means of material gain. I say not ritual or entertainment. You're not going to like this. That's okay, because I'm just an attorney that makes mistakes all the time. But I'll tell you a story how this, I can summarize my view. I was at my high school reunion about 3 years ago, and there were only about four or five of us left because we all gotten so old. But there was a bunch of us. But this Jewish girl came up to me. I've been friends with her since we were like in the first grade, and she knew I was in Young Life in high school and, you know, was Christian and everything. And so she said, Craig, you know, I just got to ask you something. She lived up in Chicago. She said her neighbors were Christians. They're always trying to witness to her. And she said, well, you know, what do you think about that, you know? I mean, I looked out the window. I remember exactly where I was. I looked out the window. I said, well, I turned and looked at her. I said, here's what I believe. I said, I believe that Judaism does not reflect the message of the Old Testament. And I believe that modern-day Christianity does not reflect the message of the New Testament. Jesus said, I've come that you might have life. He didn't say to the Catholics, I've come that you might have ritual. And he didn't say to the Protestants, I've come that you might have entertainment and sermons. I came that you might have life. And so my admonition to all of us would be, we've got to recover, you know, what the New Testament concept of church was, which is more like a Thanksgiving meal celebrated, you know, than what we normally call church, which is what Believer's Chapel and Zane used to call more like a Sunday morning meeting or Bible study. So I think all this efforts that I know a lot of y'all do to create the small groups and the worship, I think that's really getting right at the heart, you know, of New Testament teaching. How are we doing on time? We're doing okay? Oh, good.
Let's see, where was I? Oh, yeah. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 11 is a great passage. But in thinking of this, and thinking of all the different versions, you know, there's 900 million Protestants and 1.2 billion Catholics, they estimate. And, you know, when the Son of Man returns, will he find faith on the earth? I go, not very many places. Revelation 3:20, you know, we used to use that verse. I did, anyway. We used to use it as a salvation, or, I mean, as a being born again, if you let Jesus into your heart. You know, of course, it doesn't... there's some truths to that, I suppose, but it's certainly not what that verse is teaching. In fact, now I consider it one of the more humorous verses of the New Testament, because it's really knocking on the door of the church at Laodicea. There's a church service going on in there, right? Because there are people in there. Okay, where's Jesus? Hey, I don't know what y'all are doing in there, but I'm out here, you know? And I've walked into churches where I'm looking around to see if he's in there anywhere. He's not in there, you know. I'll still go. I'll still keep trying. But, you know, but that small group, the real fellowship, the life that you experience, we got to really cling to that. Ethics. Try to make it New Testament centered. You know, love at the center of it. People at the center. You know, there's a funny story about C.S. Lewis. You probably heard it many times, but when Lewis was on a walk with Hooper, well, his assistant, a man came up to him and asked for a five-pound note. Lewis pulls out a five-pound note, gives it to him, and Hooper kind of looks at him. He says, you know that man's just going to use that to buy liquor. And Lewis said, well, that's remarkable. That's exactly what I was going to use it for. Think about, you know, the people have really changed your life the most. You know, for most of us, it's going to be people that you really had a loving relationship with. I give numerous examples. We've all had those experiences. Just think back. It was somebody who really reached out to you. I'll tell you, the two of the top biblical scholars in the world, some of them I got to meet there at Basel when I was studying. One was a guy named Ernst Jenny. Jenny is the premier Old Testament scholar in Europe. And Eichrodt, who preceded him there at Basel, was the premier Old Testament scholar in the world. And do you know how Jenny came to become such a scholar? Eichrodt was his Sunday school teacher. It's so sweet. I remember he told me that one time before I was getting to have my oral exams with him. And I thought, God, that's exactly what I've always thought. You know, it's really that personal relationship with people that are really Christ-like that touch your lives and you're never the same. So, anyway, part of ethics. The eschatology, I think I'm about out of time, but eschatology, this is just almost an academic thing. But when I was teaching, we would sometimes divide the course into the various views on premillennialism, amillennialism, and postmillennialism. I would literally just tweak that. And I would put each of those views under a Roman numeral 1 and a Roman numeral 2, each of those three. Because I think the primary difference in eschatology, in terms of a theological system, is whether or not you have an Eastern view of the future or a Western view of the future. You can call it something else, but I mean Eastern view, like, you know, you're just a drop of water, it becomes, you know, part of the whole group, you're going to float around in heaven, it's not very concrete material. And then there's a Western view, which is really supported by the Bible, that, you know, we're going to be reunited with loved ones, we're going to recognize people, etc. And that point of view ultimately best leads to a new heavens and new earth. So earth is your ultimate destination, whereas the other view is just kind of an ethereal heaven. Because you see, some of the old premillennialists really believed that. They just had an Eastern view of the future. Remember, they put the parenthesis at the end. And now you just went to eternity future. There's no such thing as eternity future. We're eternal, but eternal in the sense of unending time, not timelessness. That's where they made a big mistake. So I would really accentuate that as the main difference and then start going through the subcategories of pre-mill, amill, and post-mill. I think, how much time? 2 minutes. Do we have any time for questions? No? Okay, well, I'll say one last thing. I was going to say a little more about eschatology, but let me circle back, like she said. circle back to narrative. I think that I can make a case that there is narrative prophecies, just like in the life of Abraham, in all the life of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. They all had. I'll just give you the tip of the iceberg on this because I haven't written this out, and I'm going to. Each of the patriarchs had turning points in their life. For example, Abram's turning point was when he called to offer up Isaac. Isaac's turning point, according to the structure of the story, the rest of the Old Testament knew, was when he was offered up. Turning point for Jacob, pretty easy to identify, a lot of material, but it's when he struggled, wrestled with God all night, was given the name of Israel. He was the first Israelite, making Esau the first Gentile. And then the turning point in Joseph's life, another really drawn-out story, back and forth, accepting his brothers back to himself at the end of his, and you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. And it goes back and forth. It almost seems redundant and repetitive. But just as a tip of the iceberg, I believe that also is predictive of the turning points. Not only was it the turning points in the lives of the patriarchs that Moses wrote about prophetically. Where are the great prophecies of Moses? He's supposed to be the greatest prophet. I think they're embedded in the narrative. Because the rest of the Bible's turning points is about a God like Abraham who was willing to offer up his son. It's about a God like Isaac who was willing to be offered up. It's about a God like Jacob who would first offer reconciliation to the Gentiles. And then a God like Joseph who at the end of time would welcome his brothers back to himself. So, anyway. Okay, questions? Any questions? I know I've raised a lot of things that, you know, hopefully offended at least somebody, you know. I'm sorry?
Yeah, we've got 5 minutes for questions.
Oh, good.
Okay. Could you circle back?
Circle back?
Yeah.
Could you circle back to speak on women and leaders? Oh. That's pretty good. The women in leadership in the church, you know, what I'm seeing is sort of bothers me the most is just intellectual dishonesty. There's no way you can look at Genesis 3:16 and take rule as something other than rule. There's no way to look at the passage in Timothy and see that this means that, you know, I mean, we could go through, I don't know where to start on which passages we're talking about, but I just don't see any justification for it. However, I want to point this out. Having made those statements about the church, I see the bigger problem is not so much that women want to preach in the church. The bigger problem is that the church has evolved into something that's not the New Testament church where it didn't make any sense for a woman to have that leadership. You see, if the church was like that Thanksgiving meal where you really had to have strong leadership, then nobody would be thinking that. You know, as long as you're going to treat it just as a sharing of information like a teacher, well, why can't a woman do that as well as a man? Probably can. Well, we're just going to share this information on Sunday morning. But that's not what the New Testament church was, so that's where we really went astray, you know, in getting away from the New Testament concept. For example, we might all agree that a woman's probably not going to be an NFL quarterback. But if we changed the names and all of a sudden said, you know, this video game, that's the NFL, and this is a quarterback, then why can't a woman be an NFL quarterback? Because it no longer means what it meant in the New Testament. Yeah.
This one's about where do you put Hebrews in your fourth?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it could be comprehensive, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I would put it with, if I had to put it anywhere, I'd put it with Matthew, because Matthew's showing the fulfillment of the Old Testament.
Okay.
Yeah, I would definitely put it with Matthew if I had to, but I haven't seen the linguistic correlation.
What about a book on philosophy? Is there something you recommend on that?
Don't know.
Okay.
No.
And this one is about the idea of two dimensions, explaining that.
Could you further explain the of living in two dimensions, sovereignty and choice? Oh, well, I don't know about we living in the same dimension, that the statement are not talking about the same dimension. If I said there's a chair in this room and there's not a chair in this room, that really can't be true unless we're equivocating on language because they're all in the same dimension. But if I said that God chooses and man chooses at the same time, you're not speaking of the same dimension, so both could be 100% true. It'd be like saying when Romeo kissed Juliet, did he do it because he wanted to? Or because Shakespeare wanted him to. You know, so both can be true.
This is about biblical and systematic theology.
Oh, okay. Yeah, those are kind of technical terms we use sometimes in, you know, in just by convention. I mean, it doesn't have to be. But normally we talk, biblical theology refers to the historical unfolding of doctrine. Like what I would be doing is trying to trace, let's say you're going to trace conversion, you know, through Matthew, through Mark, through the Pauline corpus and then through the Johannine literature, then you would, that would be the beginning, then to try to correlate, make sure none of it contradict each other. I mean, you got a real problem there, but if they don't, then you just integrate it into a coherent systematic theology. So that precedes it. So, I mean, theoretically, when we were in school, we always said our biblical theology had to precede the systematics. That's all. Just words, conventional use of it.